Accession number 9902, reel 3.
Take 3. Travelling on the Burma Road. We happened to have a car, a station wagon, which was being taken down to Dali, from Kunming to Dali. And I was alone with him in the car, and we had no mechanic. And we got stuck in the mud. And I was a pretty feeble pusher of the car. And Gordon said, well, we have to wait for somebody to come along the road and help us. We're right in the middle of one of these treacherous bits of road that hadn't settled. And some students came along, two or three boys and a girl. And the girl was next to me and pushing at one side. And she suddenly turned to me and looked at me. It was rather dusk at the time. She said, Nibus a Han, Ren. I said,
are you a Han, that means?
Han, yes, H-A-N. Han. You're not a Han, I said, no. I could speak Chinese by that time. What was Ying Wen? Oh, and you see, it happened to be 1940. And all the newspapers had been full of the British bringing opium into China from India and acquiring Hong Kong. You see, that Hong Kong was a barren rock. They said, oh, well, if you want a piece of ground to put up a shed to hold your opium, you better have that piece of ground. We don't have many use for it, and it happened to be Hong Kong. And from Hong Kong, you see, that piece, barren bit of rock, now we've got part of the British Empire.
Why were the papers full of it in 1940?
100 years.
I see, yes.
1840 it happened. Opium wars.
Yes, and so would they not help you push your car after that?
I would have been left. If Gordon had not used all his diplomacy and coaxing, perfect Chinese, all the right polite words, you know, how he said, Ching Wan, oh, can I possibly ask you to do this and that? You know, it's a lot to learn, is how to deal with the situation. Oh, well, we are helping the Chinese now. We weren't born 100 years ago, were we? Here we are helping you. And we're helping you against these awful Japanese with all these bombs being thrown at us.
Yes, I think if I might go back now, you know, we've established that your husband's role was working under the nationalist control, helping them with the Salt Gabelle,
Salt Gabelle. I've got a book about Sir Richard Dane's reforms. I've got...
And I suppose your husband had the job of travelling about the mines, did he?
Well, there was an inspectorate built up in 1920, I think it was, when Sir Richard Dane left China. And he had left the whole of the Indian system operating in the proper way in China, because he travelled all over the place in 4 or 5 years that he was employed by the Chinese government. And they didn't know how to collect it as a consolidated tax. When they were taxing, they found that some people were taxing pig bristles, some people were taxing leather or something or other, but they consolidated this into the national salt gabelle. And sometimes it was called gabelle if it happened to be in Indochina, where the French influence was stronger. And when it was all over Manchuria and North China, it was just called the Salt Inspectorate. And the inspectors...
Was it like a nationalised industry?
It was a nationalised industry in that it had to be financed by foreigners. And that, of course, began to be anathema to the nationalist Chinese. They said, oh, we don't want these foreigners helping us. You see, suddenly they were against the foreigner. Though they wouldn't be against Gordon, because he knew so much from the beginning, and he knew Chinese and lived with the Chinese. he wasn't a tall Chinese to look at. He was a great big man, 6 foot. I suppose he was... His heart was in China. He never left China. I should have been living in Hong Kong, I think, because though the people in Hong Kong didn't speak Chinese, they were speaking English, you see. He was prized by the Chinese, I think, because of his connection with Sir Richard Dane. They knew that he was incorruptible. He wasn't going to line his pockets. He was well paid because he was a senior. The other young men who came to join were, some of them were in the British Navy. There was one called Croom who went about with Gordon. He didn't know Chinese. I mean, everybody was subordinate to Gordon because he was a senior foreigner. And he was sent up to oppose the Japanese army who were stealing all Chinese things in Manchuria. He was sent up to Dalian in 1932, I think it was. And he spread-eagled himself against the vault of the bank. But he was pushed out of the way by Japanese bayonets. And so when Gordon had to give his account of this force majeure, he told the Lytton Commission who came out to examine the taking over of Manchuria that he had to yield to superior force. He couldn't oppose the Japanese army. And then the Japanese came to the whole of Manchuria, and it became Manchukuo. And they put a puppet in charge. They put a little emperor, 3 years old, as the head of the government there. And that became Japan. They didn't declare war on China, but they penetrated into the whole of North China so that when they wanted to come into Peking, they had an open door.
Do you remember that yourself,
yes.
The Manchurian incident?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Because I was there when Lord Lytton came,
yes,
to Manchuria.
Do you know what, you know, how the British colony, what you thought of that?
There was no colony at all. Mm. We got concessions through the Opium War. Mm. We sent a gunboat because the Chinese said, you're not going to have any Chinese property. We don't want you here. You get out. And we still had this opium, which we got from India. I'm sure, perfectly certain, the Chinese knew all about the growing of opium because they had large quantities in West China. We could see fields of poppies growing when we went down there. And that wasn't grown by the Indians. But in India, we had quite a lot of opium grown in the hills of India, and in the East India Company, which traded with India and then round by the Far East, we had some opium we wanted to get rid of, and we wanted godowns in South China to put this opium in, and they wouldn't give us any land, you see, near Hong Kong or the Pearl River or near Canton. And we sent a gunboat. We said, if you won't give us some land to put our sheds on, we'll have to force you. And that was when the unequal treaties were made. We had...
What date are you talking about?
1840.
Yes, I don't think I ought to go back into
history. No, not that.
No, it is only things you can remember,
happening,
really, that I must ask,
yes,
you about. And I was really wondering, you know, about... the Japanese, when they went in Manchuria, what the reaction was. You know, did you feel that Britain or the League of Nations should...
I wasn't in the least interested, except that my husband was sent there to stop the Japanese army.
And he couldn't do that, of course, as you say.
Well, the whole of North China was stolen by the Japanese because they felt that Chinese people were so silly... They didn't want to fight them. I mean, Chinese really are very simple, peace-loving people. I think that is why Mao Zedong later on found that they were so cooperative, the farmers. You see, they, They only were interested in their land.
Yes. You also were saying about, you know, the Japanese could then go from Manchuria into the north, into Peking,
yes,
Tientsin.
Yes, yeah.
Well, do you remember that, the sort of Marco Polo bridge incident in 1937?
Yes, I do remember it in the newspapers. But I was then... We went home on leave in 1936, and those things were happening then. And we went from Shanghai to Yunnan, down the coast, up to Kunming, in order to look at the salt mines, which hadn't been inspected. You see, Gordon was called an inspector, and he had not seen that part of China at all. So he was sent from Shanghai to inspect the Yunnan salt mines. Now, this was really at the beginning of the time when the universities were moving from Peking, Shanghai, and all the eastern ports to the west. There was a tremendous exodus to Yunnan. There were five universities in Kunming when we were there. And you see, those are the young people who are coming round the road, reading the newspapers, and recalling 100 years before, we were encroaching on their national preserves, you see, and making them give up land so that we could put opium into a shed. And
yes,
quite honestly, that opium, I suppose, is sold for... I don't think you can teach Chinese anything about drugs. The Japanese knew that if they could get hold of cigarettes in North China, they would put opium in it and undermine the constitution of the young people, because they were rather keen on smoking cigarettes, you see. And Gordon didn't realize at the time that this was happening. We didn't know how much the Japanese were undermining the character of the youth of China, and that was their declared intention, was to get hold of the whole of China. I mean, this was their... You see, the whole business of the Japanese ambition is impossible for you to understand, as my father knew it. He said, told the Foreign Office, when he came home to England, the army is in control of Japan, and the Chinese have to be protected. Oh, said the Foreign Office in England, in the First World War, we were allies of Japan, so they are still our friends. We mustn't do anything against the Japanese, because they were our friends in the First World War. Now you tell us, they were saying to Father, that we had to be careful of the Japanese military. And you see, their influence was absolutely complete, because the whole of the Japanese nation was under the power of the military, and they had to do everything that the military said. And that is why they overstepped their goal by bombing Pearl Harbor.
Yes.
And it wasn't until then that the Americans realized what the Japanese were. They were after world domination.
But if I could go back to the situation as you experienced it, you know, in China, were you aware of the Japanese, you know, when they came down from the north and then came into Shanghai?
I was only... When Shanghai was being bombed, we had to go and try to help the Chinese get out some of their possessions from Hongqiu. Hongqiu is a poorer part on the Yangtze, or on the Huangpu, and some of our Gordon subordinates had homes there. And I remember one of the Chinese giving us a lovely sable fur as some, you know, thank you present for evacuating their family and putting them into the French concession, which was away from the bombing. You see, if you were in the British or French concessions, you were safe. But if you were in Hongqiu on the river, you weren't safe. And so the Chinese were terribly badly treated by the Japanese. I mean, it really was. It was pitiable. And especially when I went to Fujian and found them coming and stealing everything.
Yes, if I could ask you about, you know, keep to Shanghai, what did you see of the bombing there?
Oh, I saw the whole, 1937. The whole of Hongkou was alight with fires that was begun by Japanese bombs. They were sitting targets, and thousands were buried alive. And, of course, the Japanese were cock-a-hoop. They were so glad to have nobody there to oppose them.
And the foreign areas weren't touched
not
at all, you say?
No.
Well, am I right in thinking that an American ship was hit in that attack by accident?
It may have been. I should have to look that up. I don't know.
Yes.
Well, that sort of thing, you see, would make the Japanese rather careful where they bombed.
Yes.
And then they wouldn't.
Yes. You also said, you know, the way they treated the Chinese was very bad.
Oh, yes.
Did you see that yourself, Mrs. Pearson?
No, I didn't. I didn't know any Japanese at all that time. I mean, when I went to Japan, I knew them through my family, but I didn't know...
You didn't see them actually when
they
came into Shanghai?
I think the educated Japanese were horrified. I think the students were horrified. But you see, the Japanese army was so strong that they had to kowtow to the force, yeah.
Any bombing at all in Yunnan?
Yes.
In Kunming, for instance?
In 1938, when we first went there, we were living in a French house next to a canal, and we always had to remember that if it was a fine morning, we must expect Japanese planes coming from South China. They were now more or less in control of the coast. And they came always at a certain time every day. Fortunately for us, and for the Chinese, foreigners and Chinese, the Japanese are work to rule. If they begin bombing you at 2 in the afternoon, they'll come at 2 every afternoon. It's fine. So everybody in Kunming would decide, the Japanese have decided to come at 10 o'clock in the morning this week, so we'll have the sirens sounded by 10 o'clock if they've been sighted somewhere, and they would have telephone conversations with the people who had seen the planes, and they themselves had no planes to fight the Japanese, so they would have a screaming siren every morning to get everybody out of the city and into the fields where they would be safe. So I went to the rice fields every day with a collection of books, and people would take out their precious sewing machines or anything that they valued, like a porcelain vase which they hadn't had in the family for years and so on. They'd take out their precious possessions and sit in the middle of a rice field. I mean, the rice had been cut, and the ground was being prepared for the next year, but you had enough dry ground to sit on, or you put your coat or your Macintosh down, and you made a little picnic place for yourself every day. When the sky was like this and blue, we hated blue skies. We liked it to rain, but Yunnan, there's very little rain for about 8 months of the year. It's a wonderful climate.
Yes. When the planes came over, would there be many of them at one time?
Well, there would be, say, about 5, and they could wreak havoc in a crowded centre, and they always made for the city gate where you had to wait and go through a tunnel-like gate, and you would be massed in a group, and they would put their bombs right on to that. And one of my friends was at the university teaching English, a youngish man. I mean, he was a very well-known professor. He was about 40.
What was his name?
Pollard Urquhart. P-O-W-L-A-R-D, Urquhart. It was a Scottish name. He's what is known as landed gentry with a coat of arms and all. And he was a very well-known professor of English at Yunnan University, and also a professor at the English College. I'll show you a picture of the English College. He was in Peking with my great friend, Professor Shui Tian Tung, and he was going out of the East Gate, and I think a lorry was going through the East Gate, and he was scratched on the knee. And I remember him telling me, "Oh, Myrtle, I had an awful wound on my knee yesterday when I was going through the gate." And I said, "Did you go to the hospital, have it iodine put on?" "Oh, well, I did go, but they didn't do very much." And you know, he died of blood poisoning 2 days later, being taken out to the country by his brother-in-law, who had a car. They decided to go out, and he died in extreme pain. There's nobody there to help him, you see, and he hadn't taken care of himself. And he was a little bit, Gordon was very careful about immunizing any scratches and things. He'd put iodine on at once, or Dettol. But this man, you see, was above that kind of... You know, there are some people who think they live a charmed life, and they're not at all like human beings. I mean, a friend of mine who thought she would never be run down by a car, because God was looking after her. What I mean. And Arthur Pollard Urquhart was rather like that. He said, "Oh, Gordon puts on iodine whenever he gets a scratch on his face." I said, "Yes, it's sensible." And he said, "Did you put iodine on your cut on your leg?" "Oh, no." And of course he died of blood poisoning in the middle of China. And of course he was so well loved that they put up a memorial to him in the middle of nowhere at the spot where he died. And he was in the middle of the country, and he died with his brother-in-law, who had taken him there for safety and in the greatest possible pain. I imagine, I don't know what happens to people if their blood is...
Devastation very great in Kunming.
You never knew whether your house would be bombed, and you never knew whether you would go back to ruin. Your shops would be just as it was in London.
How long did it last, this sort of raiding?
Well, this business lasted before our war began, 1938, and then I remember we were in the streets of Kunming when war was declared in England, after Poland, you see, was overrun. In 1939, we were in Kunming. And at that point, we were asked to go to Fujian, across the country, because, you see, you could go from one end of China to another, because they weren't... The fighting wasn't between two people facing each other, one south of the Yangtze and one north of the Yangtze, but it was from above. So there was always a passage through neutral territory, anywhere where you could get through. There was no fighting on the ground so much as bombing from the air.
How would you have been regarded by the Japanese, though, bearing in mind your husband was working...
They wanted Gordon to go on their side. And when we got to Fujian, they were planning a raid to rob everything of value in Fuzhou. We had a big house in Fuzhou, and Gordon had an office staff, about 200, and they all had homes there, and a big office where he went every morning. And he had a caller, a Japanese, had come in from Taiwan, from Formosa, across the strait, and a consul came to see him, and they said, "Mr. Pearson, we want you to come over to be the puppet governor of Fujian, because you know all about the sort." So Gordon said, "Well, you know much more about the collection of salt and all the creeks and bays where salt is made in Fujian, because you've been studying it for years. All your photographers have been here for years, photographing places where you can put up buildings and have your inspectors and so on. You know much about the tide, more about the tides and the creeks and everything than I do. I know something about the collection of the money, and you have the governor of the province under your... You imprisoned him, and you've got him under control. And I can't do anything more than you know and do already. This was before we were in the war against the Japanese. You see, we were not at war with Japan. We were at war with Germany. And so before Pearl Harbor, even the Americans were not at war with Japan. And that was going to happen the next year. You see, for 1940, the whole of 1940, we were being robbed of tea, timber, all the books in the Fuchao Library were taken to Taiwan and then transported to Tokyo. So if you want to know anything about China now, you have to go to Tokyo libraries to find out, because all those books are now, as in war, everything is carried off as booty. And the Japanese are very fond of collecting beautiful blackwood furniture, and all the houses were robbed. Of any sort of house. Our house was gone over with a tooth comb. We had nothing of real value except to ourselves. And they knew that we wanted our wireless. It was then wirelesses were rather precious. And our gardener knew that if he wanted to get Gordon's good favor, he would bury the wireless. We had to be evacuated because the Japanese were encroaching rather far inland. And so we went for about 100 miles up the Min River and then on a tributary to Gungchuan, a place inland, for a whole 6 months till the Japanese had stopped their robbing, because the office staff had a lot of young women and children, and they were frightened of the Japanese army. So as we had a big house, we could let them have one side of it and put anybody in that they found were too terrified to live at home. So our house really was a refuge for quite a number of young women who came and lived there because they were frightened of going to the streets while the Japanese were about.
And these would have been European women, would they?
Or no, they're Chinese.
Chinese, yes.
Yes, we were entirely Chinese.
And yes, I was wondering, you know, did you see yourself any violation of
no.
Chinese women?
The Japanese were utterly controlled, utterly disciplined in that raid, because they were going systematically to rob everything from Fuchao and denude it of any valuables. And we were, of course, in a big house. They would like to have taken over our house, but they couldn't because we weren't at war with them. The Americans and the British were not at war with Japan then.
And yet you say they went over your things. Is that right? They went through
The consul who came to our house said, the only thing of value, I think, is your wireless. And we said, yes, that's the way we get the news. Oh, well, of course, they knew that they were going to take over Fuchao the next year. Well, we were evacuated because the staff were really in terror. They were going to be captured by somebody. The governor wanted to have the whole money, the salt money. It wasn't to go to Chiang Kai-shek, it wasn't to go to national funds. It was to go into the provincial bank. And he felt that he had control, but the Japanese made him a prisoner, so he had no control at all of the salt revenue.